بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Leader's speech in meeting with members of Assembly of Experts. This is part of a speech delivered on August 31, 2006 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with members of the Assembly of Experts.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I welcome all the honorable gentlemen and I ask Allah, the Exalted, to accept your efforts and endeavors and to bestow His blessings and mercy on everyone. I deem it necessary to thank the current members of the Assembly of Experts who held their last meeting and who carried out valuable tasks during their term of responsibility. Primarily, they held numerous meetings, almost two times more than the previous term. They paid attention to important issues in these meetings and they carried out many other tasks. It is necessary for the public opinion inside the country to be informed of these moves and measures. For example, good tasks have been carried out in the secretariat of this assembly, such as publishing the Islamic Government magazine. Many editions of this magazine have been published, which involve good and research-based issues. A research center has been established where certain issues are brought up and examined. In this center, scholarly and expert meetings have been held on issues related to the Assembly of Experts. Moreover, scholarly programs related to the issue of Wilayat Faqih and the leadership have been prepared with the cooperation of the IRIB. These programs have been broadcasted for the people. These are the valuable tasks that have been carried out. The manifestos of the Assembly of Experts in each term are very reasonable and they include important discussions which indicate the orientation of the scholarly and political personalities of the country towards the fundamental issues of the revolution and the Islamic Republic. I have seen their manifesto in this meeting. Therefore, we should thank each and every one of the gentlemen in this assembly. What I want to discuss today is the issue of the position of the Assembly of Experts. In fact, the Assembly of Experts is a great source of support for the Islamic Republic. It is the spiritual wealth fund of the Islamic Republic. It is a source of support and a spiritual fund, and it should be prepared energetically and up to date when necessary. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. in the limelight.
Snake bites annually cost India's citizens the equivalent of 3 million years of health and productivity. That figure, reported at a meeting last month, puts the spotlight on survivors of the bites who are left with disabling conditions such as amputation, kidney disease, and severe scarring. Stay with us for an article in this regard penned by Kerry Arnold, a commentator and writer, under the heading, Snake Bite Steals Millions of Years of Quality Life in India. The analysis provides the first estimation of the toll of snake bites on survivors in India. It also confirms an earlier calculation showing that over half of the world's snake bite deaths occur in the country, demonstrating the need for greater investment in preventive measures. Snake bite is just still really not very well studied or understood at the same level as a lot of these other tropical diseases, says Nick Roberts, who was part of the team at Seattle-based University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, IHME, that calculated the latest figures. The World Health Organization, WHO, designated poisoning by snake bite a neglected tropical disease in 2017, and last year launched a global initiative to halve the number of deaths and disabilities it causes by 2030. The initiative highlights the need for better data, says Prabhat Jha, director of the Center for Global Health Research in Toronto, Canada. If the goal is to reduce the snake bite deaths by half, then you need to know where the problems are. Because many people who are bitten by snakes never enter hospitals or healthcare centers, they're not formally recorded, and researchers frequently underestimate the impact of the bites across the globe. Snake bite also doesn't receive a lot of attention because it is a disease affecting mainly impoverished farmers and their families in rural areas. Snake bite disease takes a huge toll on India, partly because the subcontinent is home to so many different types of snakes. 60 of the country's nearly 300 species are highly venomous, explains Priyanka Kadam, president and founder of the Snake Bite Healing and Education Society, an organization in Mumbai. It can also be impossible for those bitten in remote parts of the country to get treatment because the nearest health clinic might be several hours away, she says. Even then, clinics don't always have anti-venom on hand, and if they do, it might not have been stored properly or be of good quality. Because so few of those poisoned by snake bites are treated in hospital, concrete data on the impact of the bites has been challenging to obtain. Global estimates of snake bite deaths have ranged from 50,000 to 125,000. In India alone, they have varied from 11,000 to 50,000. In 2011, Jha and his colleagues tried to nail down more accurate estimates for snake bite deaths in India. He runs the Million Death Study, in effect to clarify causes of death in the country using verbal reports from family and physicians. On the basis of these reports, Jha calculated that 45,900 snake bite deaths occur each year in India, sparing officials to revise worldwide figures. Today, the WHO gives a range of 81,000 to 138,000 annual snake bite deaths globally. The IHME analysis provides the first quantitative information on the long-term effects for people who survive snake bites. Such estimates are important, says Kadam, because they can provide insight into healthcare costs and other societal burdens. The analysis also broadly supports Jahan's estimation of the number of snakebite deaths, finding that about 52,000 people died of a snakebite in India last year. It used a different data source from Jahan, however, the 2019 Global Burden of Disease GBD study. This data set, also used by the WHO, provides worldwide estimates on illness and death for 369 diseases and injuries using official vital statistics and verbal autopsy reports, allowing scientists to compare the burden of a snake bite between countries. Jahan, however, is critical of the accuracy of the latest analysis, contending that the GBD study uses complex and non-transparent models to determine how many people died and how. IHME has also caught heat recently for the transparency of its COVID-19 models, although those efforts remain separate from the snakebite work. Roberts acknowledges that the GBD study isn't perfect, but said that our modeled estimates attempt to use high-quality data, correct possible biases in the data, and create accurate estimates at scale. No matter what estimates are used, says Roberts, the WHO's goal to halve snakebite deaths and disabilities by 2030 is ambitious. We are not on track to meet it, he adds, given that snakebite deaths in India have declined only slightly, if at all, over the past decade. Kadam, whose organization works with scientists and policymakers to reduce the impact of a snakebite in India, says the data show an urgent need for a focused change at the policy level and access to basic healthcare, particularly in rural areas where many people live.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Good morning.
Good morning. How is everything? Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The debate.
Britain and the European Union have failed to agree on any solutions to ease post-Brexit trade with Northern Ireland and exchange threats in a standoff that could cloud the G7 International Summit over the weekend. Since Britain completed its arduous exit from the EU late last year, its relations with Brussels have sunk, with each side accusing the other of bad faith over a part of their Brexit deal that covers goods movements to Northern Ireland. Britain says that the ball is very much in the EU's court with regards to the implementation of the protocol. The EU says its patience with the UK is running out and threatened trade sanctions if London unilaterally broke its promises. Well, we're now joined by our correspondent, Amina Taylor, who's with us from the British capital, London, with more on that. Amina?
Well, dear, it was always going to be this way, wasn't it? Boris Johnson and his team essentially kicked a fundamental aspect of post-Brexit agreements into the long grass. And now I'm afraid those chickens are coming home to roost, because Joe Biden, the U.S. president, is very much a man whose Irish roots have been one of the things that has propped up his rise through U.S. politics. And for so many people in Ireland, they feel that this is a betrayal. They feel this is a complete betrayal of everything that was previously negotiated, and something that London decided that it didn't really like how it looked, so it was going to just drop a new deal after they had agreed with the EU.
All right, thanks a lot, Amina. Taylor joining us from the British capital, London. We're now joined by senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, who's with us from New York. Mr. Williams, welcome to the program. Why have the Tories changed their tune on the Northern Ireland protocol?
Mostly, I think, because they've only just discovered what it all entails. The whole Brexit deal was rushed through by Boris Johnson for internal advantage, so he could become the leadership, so he could become the leader of the Conservative Party. So he didn't really care about the details. He hasn't looked at the details. They didn't have contingency plans. So they've really painted themselves into a corner. They had a Northern Ireland agreement, which was the Good Friday Agreement, which binding international agreement, which they've signed on to. And the terms that they've agreed for the to get the Brexit deal rushed through, they just contravene it straightforward. There's no way he can square the circle to everyone's satisfaction. He can either isolate his allies in amongst the unionists in Northern Ireland by imposing a serious barrier against them, or he's got to reintroduce the Irish border, the Northern Irish Republic of Ireland border again, which contravenes his pledges to the EU and to Joe Biden, it would appear. So, really, he's painted himself into a corner, and no amount of his usual gymnastics and cavortings can get him out of it. I really cannot see the end results of this, because there's no solution that everyone will find acceptable. He's got a virtual tariff war, so goods going through Northern Ireland on the way to Ireland will have to face a real customs barrier in one way or another, whether it's actually there or not, a virtual customs barrier. They have to pay tariffs, and they have to abide by the laws of the European Union and the treaties, utter absurdity of this, which your readers will have missed, I presume, is the sausage war. That, Ireland is big on pork products and sausages, and there's now the issue of whether supermarket sausages made in Britain can be exported to Northern Ireland, because Britain has also pulled out of all the health and safety regulations that the European Union had. And the European Union says, quite rightly, that if you want to import foodstuffs into the European Union, they have to meet our standards. So Boris Johnson has blithely said, no, that's why we left the European Union. We don't want to abide by European standards. And so he's yet himself, yet another corner to paint himself into. This is a multi-sided room with many corners, and he's painted himself into all of them.
Indeed. Journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas is joining us now on tonight's debate from London. Mr. Abbas, welcome to the program. Boris Johnson, he claims that the EU's demands for checks on goods moving between Great Britain and Northern Ireland are too inconvenient and are disrupting trade. Well, they weren't imposed on Britain. It was an agreement that was negotiated. Why does London not want to honor its own handiwork?
Because London didn't think about the consequences of Brexit. The people who were pushing for this exit did it in the most bizarre, most rash manner. Even the actual announcing of the whole process of having a referendum, which seemed needless in the first place, to be fair, it seemed to be something more convenient for the Tory party at that time than the nation itself, was quite a ridiculous notion. And then, of course, the way that it was rushed through, the lack of information, the lies, the downright extra lies, and the outright lies were manifested. I mean, look, they said that Brexit would help the country experience immediate cost savings. Well, that's going to be pretty dubious. I mean, they said that it was because they were paying £13.1 billion in membership dues, and et cetera. So, but they didn't mention what they got out of the EU at that time, and most of the public remained ignorant of that. They said Brexit would shift the emphasis of trade for Britain. But again, you see already now that they're moaning and groaning, and their much-wanted exercises in trying to create agreements outside of the EU with the rest of the world aren't going particularly famously. It's an awfully difficult task to renegotiate all these agreements that were rolled into one. And I think, you know, again, this idea of establishing the sovereignty of Britain was very powerful. It was a very emotive and emotional message at the time, on the back of which Boris and his cohort, who were pushing for this premature exit, I would say, actually used the whole British nationalism, or the English nationalism, probably more to the point, because Scotland doesn't seem that keen on this business of Brexit. And we're seeing that Northern Ireland was always going to be the problem, the sting in the tail, if you like, because, of course, it's got the connections with Ireland itself, and that becomes an open door for all sorts of, you know, of course, contradictions, which they're now beginning to uncover. I think the fact that Biden has weighed in and America has weighed in shows where they are pushing the Brits towards. I mean, of course, if they don't go with the Biden scenario, then they're arguably going to suffer with their main card that they were using as a way of sort of balancing the books from the trade they'd lose with the EU, i.e. America, and its vast market where they were supposed to go and push their exports, etc. Well, after what Biden has said, it's quite clear that he's not terribly happy, and America is not terribly happy in giving Britain a carte blanche. So there's been a lot of failures, and I could go on with all the other lies. You know, they said Brexit would reduce the issues with forced immigration associated with the EU. Well, again, another fact that is almost impossible for them to deal with, that Britain can't do without immigrant workers to do the low-end jobs, you know, the fruit pickers, the late-night hotel porters and cleaners, and the people who will do all the jobs which the British public or the British citizenry will leave till the last on their list. So, of course, these are just some of the, if you like, lies and outright sort of foolishness, which right. Is now gradually going to get exposed.
Let's go back to Ian Williams in New York. Ian, the EU's threatening trade sanctions if Johnson unilaterally breaks promises that he made relating to Northern Ireland. If this row escalates any further, are we looking at the possibility of a full-blown trade war, in your opinion?
I think it's very possible. The Europeans, quite understandably, have very little patience for Britain at the moment. They have even less patience for Boris Johnson and his posturings. And, you know, they really see, you know, that they're not being unreasonable. They're asking that they, you know, the agreements as they agreed be actually implemented. You know, it's interesting that one of the reasons why Britain wanted to opt out of European standards is so that they could have a trade deal with America that that encompasses Trump's insistence that they allow polluted, effectively hormone-ridden, bleached American meat products into Britain. That was one of the deals. So he opted out of Europe so they could get that, and now he finds that British sausages, heaven help us, are barred from Northern Ireland. And issue after issue, they just did not think through. They did it on the spur to get a momentary political advantage, to make Boris Johnson the leader of the Conservative Party and the Prime Minister. And over, they didn't think about the implications for the union with Scotland, They didn't think about the implications of the Northern Ireland issue. They didn't think about the implications of the US in the end. Because, you know, Britain still pretends it has a special relationship with the US. But the special relationship is a completely subordinate, servile one. And the US, it finds Britain very useful. It's a sort of diplomatic sepoy who does what the Americans want quite often. But, I mean, the Americans don't need Britain in a serious way, but Britain seriously needs America if it's to maintain its standing in the world. Its much vaunted nuclear deterrent is basically borrowed from the Americans. It's on a lease. They're renting it from the Americans. They have to give it back if the Americans don't renew it, or the Americans don't want to help them renew the Trident. So that's Britain's pretensions as a nuclear power. And, I mean, that's what we're all about in many ways. It's about posturing and position, and it's the hanging on by Boris Johnson's fingernails to the illusion that Britain, well, it is a big power, but not a major power. And he's going to fall flat on his face in the mud, or in the Irish Sea at least, at this one.
All right, Sayed Mohsen Abbas, the UK, it says that we can work something out and all is not lost. EU's negotiators, they said the recent talks were not good at all. How do you explain this heavy contrast in tone?
Well, clearly somebody's being dishonest. I rather suspect it's the British, because the EU has been very robust and very straightforward in what it's demanded and wanted. Eventually, they seem to bundle through some kind of agreement over the line. Even that looked very, very dubious at one point. And now we're going backwards yet again. It's sometimes one wonders whoever is constructing this, whether they actually want, from the British policymaking side, whether they actually want this chaos to continue. Of course, you've got COVID, you've had the collapse of the economy, which will quietly begin to manifest in real terms for the hardship on people. And on top of that, you've got Brexit, where, you know, the possibility of new jobs, etc., of course, was a big issue that was on the table at the time. You know, there were estimates that 3 million jobs in Britain were connected to trade policies, procedures or activities at that time, and separating from Europe risked and created a risk where these employment opportunities would be lost. And that's exactly still the case, even more so now, given that COVID-19 has affected the economy even more. You know, they said that, of course, Brexit would improve border security. Another nonsense. I mean, there was no real way that you could stop the flow of people and the movement if you're continuing with wars in the Middle East, for instance, as Britain partakes very, very vigorously in across Syria, Afghanistan, and various other places where they've been, of course, triggering the migrant crisis into Europe. So, you know, on the one hand, you're promising that Brexit will improve all this border security, reduce the migrants' population, but yet you're continuing to fuel war for the sake of your, again, economic interests abroad. So, you know, again, there were these kind of paradoxes. And you know, they also talked about how it would, give British bureaucracy freedom, you know, sovereignty and freedom of the bureaucracy. Well, the fact is that the City of London, the Corporation of London here, runs most of our economic trajectory and direction, I would say, behind in the corridors of power. Westminster has almost very little say when it comes to some of these economic realities. And again, I think that if you're going to be saying, oh, we're not going to be controlled by the European technocrats and the bureaucrats, but we're going to do it from Westminster, that's again a kind of fallacy, because Britain is in debt, is getting increasingly more and more in debt. Who's it in debt to? Most of the guys who are down there in the City of London, the corporate banksters and whatever networks they have around them. And it's those folk that actually ultimately underwrite Britain in one shape or form economically. You know, 20-30% of the GDP on paper is generated by that square mile in London. So they are a factor which never gets really drawn into these discussions. And they were notably very mute on Brexit. So there are many factors which, prove the lie that Boris and the Tory government pushed through in terms of this fiasco of Brexit.
There are many factors, indeed. Ian Williams, France threatens to veto any changes to the Brexit deal. The French President Emmanuel Macron, he lambasted the UK for seeking to renegotiate the NI protocol only months after agreeing to it. Macron said, nothing is renegotiable and everything should be applied. That's a lot of opposition to the UK's behavior. Unpack Macron's comments for us, please.
It's self-evident. They spent a lot of time negotiating a deal that the British asked for. Remember, the British left. They weren't thrown out. They left despite pleas from people in Europe that they shouldn't. They left. They were offered. They could have taken longer to negotiate and talk around the deals, but they spent 2 years basically spinning wheels and not really doing much in the way of negotiation. Because this is the ineptitude of this. The Conservative Party at least used to pretend to be competent. Competent but callous. I mean, these are incompetent and callous. They didn't factor in all of these details. And we saw that over the COVID as well. I mean, you know, the biggest death rate in the world, or the highest death rate in the world, massive close downs. And it was all because the buffoon in chief was busily pretending that things didn't really happen. He sat there with his hands, you know, like three wise monkeys in one. Do no evil, hear no evil, see no evil. He didn't speak a lot of evil, though. But mostly he was the epitome of callous incompetence. And he still is. And, you know, the real tragedy of Britain is there's no serious opposition to this as well. It's worth mentioning, by the way, that the Labour Party has never organised in Northern Ireland, and actually it's sort of one of its bedrock policies has always been in favour of a united Ireland, with Northern Ireland being separate from Britain. So they're in there's a bit of a dichotomy here as well. So, you know... The union was a conservative project. The Conservative Party used to be called the Conservative and Unionist Party. The union with Northern Ireland was their biggest strength. It was one of the reasons they got votes in places like Scotland and in the old days in Liverpool, because they were the Conservative and Unionist Party. And, you know, they've thrown away their historical stuff on this, and they're about to throw away Northern Ireland, it would appear. Scotland, of course, they've managed to alienate almost completely. It's a moot point how long it will last. This is a really tragically disastrous government for Britain, whichever side of the political spectrum you're on. You know, Britain is being dismembered politically, economically, and, you know, diplomatically. And it's a self-inflicted wound.
Mohsen Abbas, the EU has set all Brexit border checks on food, including chilled meats. Entering Northern Ireland from Great Britain would be abolished if the UK signed up to a Swiss-style deal. The UK has already ruled out this option because it requires regulatory alignment with the EU. Now, even if it was temporary, why would Brussels put forth such a solution? The UK didn't go through Brexit just to sign up to EU law again.
Well, I think that they toyed around with the Norwegian model, and now this Swiss model gets talked about. Again, ultimately, what you've got to look at is the incompetence, as my colleague has said, of this establishment, the incompetence actually of the civil service and the background teams that have been advising as well, I would say. I think it seems to be a comedy of errors all the way down the line, and whatever way they try to get out of it, the fact is that you've got a whole list of cons that Brexit was bound to bring in, you know, the elimination of protection of equal pay, maternity leaves and safe workplaces, that's all on the line, you know, all those equal rights for women, the human rights laws, etc. That's also going to be, you know, a lot of it's going to be going down the drain. You know, Brexit, you know, changing the perspective of Britain being the gateway to Europe. You know, how that was one thing which, you know, also was mooted. It was one of the reasons Britain decided to avoid the Eurozone. The strength of its currency was higher, you know. But again, those are delusions, because once your business isn't going well and you've got no investment coming in, your trade is going down, then of course the value of your own currency is going to drop and the economics will start falling all around you. Of course, you know, the labor shortage that I briefly mentioned, would kick in, because I know that there are lots of immigrants who, from Poland, certainly the East European immigrants, there's been a massive exodus in I think almost one, some quotes I've had are up to a million plus immigrant workers have already given up on Britain because they just don't see the future here. And these were people who were doing work which was obviously building the economy of Britain, you know. You know, again, also the nonsense around breaking off with such a massive conglomerate of European nations is bound to impact the intelligence the intelligence networks,
sure.
You know, the sharing of information which was there on the cards. That's all going to be much, much more difficult to sort of access. They're not going to be as freely giving that regard and make it weaker as well. Many, many other things I can say that the foreign direct investments in Britain that are being received, they will suffer. The list is endless in terms of the disasters that Brexit is very, very likely to bring in. It hasn't even started yet, I'd say. The Northern Ireland issue is just the tip of the iceberg.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mr. Abbo. Sorry to jump in there. We're fresh out of time for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, joining us from London. Also thanks to senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, Mr. Ian Williams, speaking to us from New York. Also special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Research from NASA has suggested that it is possible for humans to maneuver much faster on the moon than the Apollo astronauts did in their missions between 1969 and 1972. Theoretically, walking the circumference of the moon could be done faster than previously predicted. We have prepared for you an article authored by Harry Baker. The piece is titled, How Long Would It Take to Walk Around Moon? The article was published on Life Science website. Quicker than we originally believe, but it's a logistical nightmare. From our vantage point on Earth, the moon looks small. But if you were to hop in on a spaceship, don a spacesuit, and go on an epic lunar hike, how long would it take to walk all the way around it? The answer depends on myriad factors, including how fast you can walk, how much time every day you spend walking, and what detours you'll need to take to avoid dangerous topography. Such a trip around the moon could take longer than a year, but in reality, there are a lot more challenges to overcome. According to NASA, a total of 12 humans have stepped foot on the lunar surface, all of whom were part of the Apollo missions between 1969 and 1972. The footage that was beamed back to Earth showed how challenging and apparently fun it was to walk, or more accurately bounce, around in the moon's low gravity, which is 1/6 of the Earth's gravity. However, research from NASA has since suggested that it is possible for humans to maneuver much faster on the moon than the Apollo astronauts did. Theoretically, walking the circumference of the moon could be done faster than previously predicted. According to NASA, during the Apollo missions, astronauts bounced around the surface at a casual 1.4 miles per hour, or 2.2 kilometers per hour. This slow speed was mainly due to their chunky, pressurized spacesuits that were not designed with mobility in mind. If the moonwalkers had sported sleeker suits, they might have found it a lot easier to move around and, as a result, pick up the pace. In 2014, a NASA study published in the Journal of Experimental Biology tested how fast humans could walk and run in simulated lunar gravity. To do this, the team got 8 participants, 3 of which were astronauts, to use a treadmill on board a DC-9 aircraft, which flew special parabolic trajectories on Earth to simulate gravity on the moon for up to 20 seconds at a time. This experiment revealed that the participants were able to walk to up to 3.1 miles per hour or 5 kilometers per hour before breaking into a run. According to the researcher, this is not only more than double the walking speed managed by the Apollo astronauts, but also fairly close to 4.5 miles per hour or 7.2 kilometers per hour average maximum walking speed on Earth. The participants pulled off these fast speeds because they were able to freely swing their arms, similar to how humans run on Earth. This pendulum motion created a downward force, which partially compensated for a lack of gravity. One of the reasons the Apollo astronauts were so slow on the lunar surface was because they couldn't do this properly due to their chunky spacesuits. At this new hypothetical maximum speed, it will take about 91 days to walk the 6,786 miles or 10,921 kilometers circumference of the moon. For context, it will take around 334 days to walk non-stop, that is, non-stopping, not stopping or sleeping or eating, around the 24,901 mile or 40,075 kilometers circumference of the Earth at this speed, although it is impossible to do so because of the oceans. Obviously, it's not possible to walk non-stop for 91 days, so the actual walk around the moon would take much longer. Walking around the moon also poses a number of different challenges. Aidan Cowley, a scientific advisor at the European Space Agency, ESA, told Live Science, "I think logistically it could be done, but it would be a very strange mission to support. One of the biggest challenges would be carrying supplies such as water, food and oxygen." Aidan Cowley said, "I don't think you'd be carrying them in your backpack," adding, "because that'd be far too much mass even if you're at 1/6 the gravity of the Earth." He added, "Therefore, you would need to have a support vehicle with you, This vehicle could also double as shelter. Aidan Cowley noted, a lot of the agencies are looking into the concept of having a pressurized rover, which can actually support the astronauts when they're doing exploration missions, kind of like portable mini bases, adding, you could use that to go in at night and resupply and then go back out during the day and walk around again. Moon adventurers would also need a spacesuit with a design that allows for optimal movement. Aidan Cowley said current spacesuits are still not created with excessive locomotion in mind, but some agencies are developing form-fitting suits that will allow for the arm swing necessary to walk properly on the moon. The moon's harsh topography would also make finding a suitable route around it quite tricky, especially with meteor craters that are several miles deep. Aidan Cowley added, you would really want to go around the craters. It's just too dangerous. It would also have to factor in light and temperature when planning the route. Cowley said, at the equator of the moon and during daytime, you're looking at temperatures at around 100 degrees centigrade or 212 degrees Fahrenheit, adding, and then at nighttime, it drops to like minus 180 degrees Celsius or minus 292 degrees Fahrenheit. The lunar cycle also means there are days when there is little or no sunshine, and at least half the journey would have to be done in the dark. Aidan Cowley said providing protection against these extreme temperatures could be possible with specially designed spacesuits and the rover for protection, but the temperatures could also change the state of regolith, a fine grey soil that covers the moon's solid bedrock, and affect how fast you could walk on it. However, radiation could pose an even greater danger. Unlike the Earth, the Moon does not have a magnetic field that helps deflect radiation from reaching its surface. Aidan Cowley added, if there was no major solar activity at the time, then it may not be so bad. But if there was a solar flare or coronal ejection, and you're hit by high levels of radiation, that could make you very, very sick. According to NASA, solar flares and coronal mass ejections both release large amounts of energy and magnetize particles, but differ in the types of particles they emit, the duration of the event, and the way the radiation they produce travels through space. This type of mission would also require a huge amount of endurance training, because of the demand of exercising in low gravity on your muscles and cardiovascular system. Aidan Cowley added, you'd have to send an astronaut with ultra-marathon-level fitness to do it. He said even then, walking at a top speed would be possible only for around 3 to 4 hours a day, so if a person walked at 3.1 miles per hour or 5 kilometers per hour for 4 hours a day, then it would take an estimated 547 days, or nearly 1.5 years, to walk the moon's circumference, assuming your route isn't too disrupted by craters and you can deal with the temperature changes and radiation. Aidan Cowley added, however, humans won't have the technology or equipment to accomplish such a feat until at least the late 2030s or early 2040s. He concluded by saying, you'd never get an agency to support anything like this, but if some crazy billionaire wants to try it, maybe they can pull it off.
Good morning.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.